For most of his life, artist Jordan Esso has known that he didn't want to have children. After meeting his partner and getting married at the age of 25, he decided it was time for a vasectomy. Now, 4 years later, in an exhibition titled Strict Father Model, he has chronicled that experience. It's a 99-day multimedia show where we see, amongst other things, a detailed video of the vasectomy itself, and a series of paintings Esso made with his very own semen, both pre- and post-operation. My name is Sonia Katenjian, this is Sight Unseen, and in this interview I had with Jordan Esso, we explore what fatherhood is, the fundamental impetus to procreate, and the irrevocable choice to change your body. Here, Esso shares the story behind the image that opens his catalog, a picture of a beach in Acapulco, Mexico. Stay tuned.
It's a picture actually of a beach in Acapulco, so the point of using it has a lot to do with the population density on the coastline there and then the industrialized background. And the time frame of the photo really is the point of using it, and it has to do with the fact that in December of 2003, me and my wife, then girlfriend, were traveling with my family, and we were pregnant, but we didn't know it. That day specifically marked the spontaneous engagement, and so it sort of has that dual purpose of finding that really personal landmark that ended up defining my ideas around potential reproduction. Because before you have something like a pregnancy, and in our case it ended up being a miscarriage, I think it's pretty easy to think of these concepts very loosely and in terms of abstract definitions. For me, after that miscarriage, it was obvious to me that there could be names for these things and very specific identities. We had named the pregnancy, we had empathized with it, and that was the purpose in using a lot of these photographs that my brother had taken, because I wasn't taking any at the time.
So at that point, when you both fell pregnant together, you and your then girlfriend, soon to be wife, since you asked her to marry you on that trip, I mean, you thought you would keep that baby, or did you know that you wouldn't?
We didn't know. I think that neither one of us were really pursuing becoming parents either then or any time afterwards. So it truly was a difficult period from the time we knew we were pregnant to the time that we miscarried, and that choice of whether or not to continue the pregnancy or not was taken from us.
Had the choice not been taken from you, do you think that you would have possibly been a parent now?
I think at that time, if the decision had been solely up to my wife, yes, and if it had been solely up to me, no.
So in some ways, it was a blessing in certain ways. I mean, it's a very hard decision to make in a partnership when two people come from different viewpoints in and around having a child.
I think it'd be pretty difficult to qualify it as a blessing, because it was pretty traumatizing. Even for me, it doesn't matter that I wasn't looking to become a parent and that I'm not looking to become a parent now. When you have a very specific life at stake, and I am pro-choice, and I'm not a Christian, I'm an atheist, it still is a very critical intersection of desire and responsibility. And if we had had the child, obviously, that wouldn't be something that I would have regretted.
Miscarriage, I mean, I didn't think we would get into miscarriage at all, but I think it's an important thing to address because it's something that's so rarely talked about. Your wife going through a miscarriage was incredibly common. And it's a really painful thing to go through, but no one really ever talks about it. I mean, did you find yourself talking about the miscarriage after you had it, after you and your wife had it? What did it feel like for you? What were the kind of conversations that you were having? What were the energy of those conversations?
I think the conversation I'm having about it is happening now. I don't think we talked about it actually too much afterwards. It was, like I say, it was fairly traumatic, and we both understood what had happened and we had a sort of communal loss. And it's only now, actually, that I'm sort of looking at that from a slightly different perspective, because I have a little bit of distance. So incorporating that in the exhibition and the process of making this work has been really the first time I've addressed it since.
How would you describe parenthood? How would you describe fatherhood?
I would say that parenthood erupts out of, obviously, a biological programming. But then when it becomes interpreted as a moral teaching, when it becomes interpreted as a personal responsibility, it becomes something entirely different. And for me, I understand what it's like to be a son, and I understand what it's like to be a husband. I don't have any explicit understanding of what it's like to be a father of a human child that belongs to me. But I think that when I conceptualize that identity, I think of it as something that has a lot to do with the things that George Lakoff talks about in his Nationist Family Metaphor writings, that it has to do with empathizing with another life, and it has to do with that responsibility to that life. And to me, there is some kind of relationship that an artist has to their work that maybe fills the same kind of place, but I'd be speculating.
No, I mean, I think that a lot of artists feel that they give birth to what they create, that there are lots of metaphors there, that it's part of them, it's an extension of themselves, it's a very personal, sometimes indescribable extension of themselves. It's something that they don't want to destroy, something that they feel love towards, anger towards, all the plethora of emotions, and that's what you have towards your child to a certain extent. But, you know, you said you know what it's like to be a son, and you know what it's like to be a husband. It's not as uncommon for a man to choose to not necessarily want to be a father. For a woman to choose to not want to be a mother is more uncommon. At least it seems more surprising, especially to me, because I want to be a mother. I thought, was it an experience, and I know this is a very personal question, but was it an experience of you being a son that made you not want to be a father? Was it something about your childhood that made, I'm not trying to get Freudian with you here, but but you know what I mean?
Well, absolutely not. It had nothing to do with the way that I was raised that somehow formed my opinion on whether or not I was meant to be a father. Only possibly inversely, that sometimes people who have traumatic childhood experiences want to become a parent so that they can somehow redeem that whole family experience. So maybe inversely, I didn't have family experience that I felt needed redeeming. I had a very complete childhood emotionally and so on. So that would be the only relationship I could draw. I didn't want to become a father because I felt like my time was spoken for in a certain sense with my work, with what I felt was my premier purpose in life. But I also think that aside from my own experiences as being a son, it's hard to get away from. There is some sense of loss in raising a child, and there's some sense of endangering yourself emotionally. And I think that if I were to search deeply, I would find some aspects of that in my decision making.
I wonder how much people think about it before it actually happens and to actually do a full first to actually make a permanent choice with your physical body to change something that's very fundamental about you as a human being, which is to reproduce. I mean, that's why you're here, really, Jordan, is to reproduce, to create another Jordan or another extension of yourself. So you've sort of completely cut that very, very fundamental aspect of yourself. And you happen to be very young. I mean, 29 years old. My understanding, you started this process when you were 25. It's really young to know that. And do you see it as that sort of fundamental letting go? Is it something, it's like cutting off something inherently basic about your humanity?
It's a really important question, because when I decided to have a vasectomy, and then more importantly, once I'd had one, that entire dialogue on whether or not this surgical sterilization was a lethal instrument of some kind philosophically became a really important part of my internal dialogue. And the only conclusions that I could come to, and some of them feel a little haunting, is that it is a kind of suicide to opt out of fatherhood and to resist reproduction. It's also kind of paternicide. I felt a lot of guilt about not continuing my own family line from the perspective of my ancestors and parents. So the idea of creating a cul-de-sac out of your own genetic potential is something that I take very seriously. And it has a lot to do with the questions I pose with the work morally. I'm not preaching this. This is something prescriptive that other people should do. I'm describing my own personal process with it.
I don't take it as any sort of preaching. But I do take it as something, like I said, very fundamental. Before we get into the actual work itself and what you're revealing in it, I want to explore what that was like between you and your wife to make that decision. How attached is she to the idea of having a child? And, you know, I realize that issues of overpopulation and this world being not a great place to bring a child into are there, but how much are they there? When people say that, I'm kind of like, come on. Okay, so what, an extra person, fine, we're 6 billion people. What's wrong with 6 billion and one? But and yes, the world is bad, but you're great, so why not bring someone great into it? So, you know, I don't know, I don't really buy that. So the first thing is that I want to understand, you know, what those conversations were like with your wife. And then to really get into those sort of larger issues around why you chose to not have children.
Well, I'd want to be careful not to speak for my wife. Obviously, we're different people, and I would say that we came to a mutual decision. She wasn't looking to have children either before she met me or with me, and I think that it probably was a different kind of decision for her, being a woman, and I would leave it at that as far as trying to describe her feelings on it, except that I certainly acknowledged both personally and with the work, that she is intrinsically a member of the group that bears absolute consequences from a decision like that. It may be my body that enters into physically that commitment, but being a couple, your mate is very much affected by an idea that that sterilization should define your ability to have a family. And in terms of the other questions that you brought up, no, I agree with you that I think it's pretty easy to make an argument. And in fact, I do make the argument in one of the essays that with 6.6 billion people, there's a real consideration there. However, I think that when it comes down to it, when the rubber meets the road, when someone makes that decision for themselves, they don't usually, I would guess, make a political decision. It really has something to do more extremely with a personal sensibility.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great off-the-cuff statement, but I don't think it really, it's not the reasons why someone chooses to change their physical form to not, you know, to not have kids. So people, I'm sure people always ask you what you're working on, and when you tell them this about this project, what are some of the reactions you get? I'm sure it's very charged.
Sure, absolutely. It depends on who's talking about it. Some people might have certain objections to the idea of sterilization as a subject at all. Others might have an objection to that being the subject of an art exhibition. I think some people who are interested in art innately understand where this lies in terms of art making and in terms of diaristic art making. And then there's, for those people who are more interested in engaging with the work itself, they become very curious, and then they become very interested in, you know, how this is something that reflects broadly on everyone's reproduction. Not, this isn't really my story. This exhibition is not designed to be about me and my family. Those aspects are used because they're truths, they're personal truths, but they're a vehicle for the conversation.
Well, I didn't think about this until now, but I remember earlier in the summer, there was this Yale student who, for her graduate thesis, had repeated, I think, might have had repeated abortions. And it was an absolute outrage to so many people. I mean, the New York Times covered it extensively, and now she's probably a famous artist in Chelsea or something as a result. And, you know, part of that is because it was the Yale MFA program, which is such a revered program. And do you remember that story, and do you remember your reactions to it?
I vaguely remember that going on, and in fact, someone else has asked me about that in relation to this project. I wouldn't want to comment too specifically on that work because I'd want to know a little bit more about it, but I would say that there's a very huge difference between the way you describe what she was doing and what I'm doing. I documented a process that was going to happen, whether it was the subject of an art exhibition or not, and that's a difference, and I'm not criticizing someone who does a surgery just for an art exhibition, but that's a difference, and it's an important difference. Also, I think that when you begin discussing abortion specifically, you enter into an entirely different subject matter. This project, while about sterilization and therefore birth control, shares some relationship to abortion, but abortion is a fairly loaded and specific debate, and it's a debate that enters very quickly into a religious debate. And I think that it's important to distinguish that when I'm questioning the rights of the unconceived child, when I'm questioning what world they might end up into and what is the responsibility of the father and the mother, who in my case I define as being latently they're latent parents. We all are latent parents. And so we are born with a responsibility as parents to unconceived children. That's a philosophical discussion where I'm trying to pinpoint what are the repercussions of having children or not having children, the violations of which are potentially the violations of the self, of the community, and telescoping that out further. Possibly the entire world's interests might be violated by not having children. This is the question. It's a moral discussion. But it's different than, are the interests of God being violated or obeyed? Never really understood that, not being a Christian, that contraception could somehow violate the interests of an all-powerful God. But I would say that it is a different conversation.
No, it definitely is a different conversation. I mean, the strands are the same. I'm not surprised someone else asked you this because, you know, they're both in and around reproduction. They're both documenting physical processes and they're both artworks. Did it help you emotionally to document this process? And have you found in your life that through difficult and challenging times, you've documented those times so as to cope with that in some way or another?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a cliche for a reason, right? I also write, and I usually only write poetry when I'm going through, you know, catastrophic times. So, sure, the process of making the work about this decision, I felt was purifying in a sense. I mean, you talk about the vasectomy as being something that has sort of physical consequences beyond what the means of the operation achieve. I have staples in my body now. There's parts of my body that have been cut. Claiming one's body, you know, and this enters somewhat into feminist theory, often involves some kind of mutilation. I mean, it's one way of looking at it, and it's one way that you feel about it. That I was claiming my own identity, but in a way it involved violating my identity to do so.
Like tattoos. Reminds me of tattoos. No, really, it does. I always wonder why people get tattoos. But it's a support. So it's a sort of claiming of your body and a marking of identity. I mean, you've got a very clear understanding of a very fundamental part of your identity now that, and it's marked within your body, even though you can't necessarily see it. I think it's really interesting to track the process of something like a vasectomy. I made a documentary about birth, and we very, very clearly explained what a C-section is, what is cut and then what is cut again, and how the baby is pulled out, and the whole process. So that, because these things like C-section and vasectomy and these kind of bodily reproductive things are still somewhat mysterious, I think, in certain ways. I mean, you can explain and you can see it in textbook, you can watch a life video, but there's still a very deep sense of mystery to it all. I know that there's a video piece in your show. It's a multimedia show. There's painting, there's photography, writing, and video. Could you describe the video piece for me?
Yeah, but first I want to address specifically one thing you said about the invisibility of some of these things. I don't know exactly what word you used, but I would use the word invisibility. Because unlike a tattoo, the evidence of that resides on the exterior, whereas something that is a vasectomy, even tubal ligation, which is, you know, a more difficult thing to go through, it almost requires the leap of faith of the subject who had the surgery for the surgery to be a success. You have to believe that you're sterile. Now, I have a certain kind of evidence, and like you say, there's a video in the exhibition, very strict documentary footage. It's 15 minutes long. It shows you that this happened. And yet, from a day-to-day perspective, I have to will it to be my new identity. It has to be something I believe. So I think that's an interesting position to take, because I'm addressing blankness a lot in the exhibition. We haven't really talked about some of the source texts that I considered in structuring the exhibition, but one of them is a notebook entry by the French existentialist author Albert Camus, who wrote in 1937 that if he had to write a book about morality, it would be 100 pages long and 99 of them would be blank. And I became very interested in this statement because it had a curious sort of nature to it. Why 100 pages? And he had never, of course, made this book. I thought, I'll make this book. That was an impetus for this project. And then he hinges his statement. 99 pages of blank is really about not prescribing what morality is. That's really the existentialist position, that you take responsibility for your own morality. But the way he hinges is it with this 100th page, where he says that if he was to acknowledge one duty, it would be to love. And that's why then morality got seated in a discussion about family, because love obviously immediately relates to the way you express love, which is, I think, most immediately in a family context. So pursuing then what those 99 pages of blank, how that could be represented, and throughout my work, I'm always very interested in the difference between appearances and their corpuscular structure, their nuanced anatomy. To do that with blankness became one of the, you know, major pursuits of constructing this work, that there were thresholds that we passed through all the time that left no residue, no evidence, and a vasectomy is, in a certain sense, kind of like that. I already didn't have children. I wasn't going to have any. There are other means of birth control. So this was the actualization of a philosophy that, while traumatic to a degree, really was almost an invisible threshold in a reality that already existed. So when I structured these 99 diptychs to fulfill this idea Camus had for a 99-day issuance of blankness, and I used my semen for 99 days to make paintings below photographs of the sky, each diptych taking on its own is fairly interchangeable visually with any other in the sequence. But when you start on May 25th, the semen stain contains potent genetic material, and by the end of the 99-day sequence, it's gone. So that was one of the ways I tried to represent what that threshold was and how it was activated or deactivated.
That our genetic composition is actually fairly impermanent, that the child is an extremely permanent decision based on something that's incredibly impermanent and just disappears. I mean, is that kind of what the idea was behind that? That you can create semen that would be potent and full of possibilities of permanency, but that over the course of 99 days, that permanency would be completely gone. And what was initially one thing is now something completely different. So what you're actually losing is not as great a loss as it initially seemed to be. Is that so?
I think so. In a sense, the loss is what's diagrammatically exercised. But then, of course, we're in the age of DNA research, and I think that unlike a woman's fertility, which is represented by a set amount of eggs, a man produces sperm throughout his entire life, and in fact, I still do. It's just that the vas deferens, which is the highway that takes it from the gonads into the mix of ejaculate from the prostate, that highway's been cut off, but I'm still producing genetic material. So the potential has been removed, but in a sense, you have to acknowledge that one part of my body still thinks that that is the status quo. So this is sort of a strange way to interject this particular piece, but there's one sculpture in the exhibition that is called The 21st Century, and it involves a collection of fingernail and toenail clippings that I'd been gathering since 2000, and I sort of did this instinctually, not really understanding where I was going with this. But the detritus of the fingernail clippings, toenail clippings, eventually struck me as a really great way to acknowledge at least that while there are very specific tools and materials that are used to reproduce, in the age of advanced science, those boundaries are blurred. And so I included this sculpture, which also includes a vial of quicklime, which is a material that's often sprinkled on mass graves, or at least historically has been sprinkled on mass graves. It has to do with reducing smell. But the interesting thing about the material is its high pH actually neutralizes the organic matter and mummifies it, in a sense. So there's sometimes a misconception that it helps the bodies decompose. It preserves them. So I set that container next to the clippings of my body and put it in a bowl, wrapped it up in plastic.
I'm always fascinated by the fact that my nail contains my DNA and my hair, a strand of my hair contains all of my DNA, and that it's not just something that's inside me or inside you. It's actually all over you. So it's a very tangible and carnal way of understanding what DNA is about. But wrapping it up in plastic is a very, plastic is so suffocating. So I don't know, that's an interesting contradiction, because you don't really see living things wrapped up in plastic. But DNA seems so living. It seems so alive. It's like life. It's like the fundamental strand of life. I just want to get back to that question of not bringing a child into a world of joy. Do you really believe that when friends of yours tell you that they're pregnant and that they're having a baby, I'm sure you don't make a judgment call on it. I know you don't. But is there a part of you that thinks they're not bringing their child into a world of joy? Is there a part of you that thinks that they're bringing their child into a world of doom and desolation?
I think it's easy to adopt a pessimistic mindset that gloms on to the evidence that our world is running out of resources, that our world is overpopulated, that our world is essentially managed by corrupt autocrats and international business interests. But I don't personalize that to the extent that I think the world is innately dangerous and that I think the world is a doom and gloom place that shouldn't have children in it. That's not the position that I made the decision from, nor do I adopt that name, strict father model, to describe my process in totality. I feel in many ways that my decision to not have a child has a lot to do with my own sense of personal responsibility, that I am a very busy, career-minded person, ambitious person, a person who has a lot to say with art, and that that is realistically a very time-consuming commitment all by itself. But I could never get away from that not having children and opting out of fatherhood has to be on some level a rejection of that responsibility and empathy to nurture the next generation. I don't feel like I'm sparing children ultimately from being in a world that has consequences, but I feel that I'm somewhat negligent by not having those children. That's why I embraced the title strict father model. It was inversely that I embraced that. I feel that my decisions to not have children were informed by other interests. I don't feel that I'm sparing them from a world of doom and gloom.
Those were the words of artist Jordan Esso. You can see more of his work at SOESSOE.com. My name is Sonny Katunjian. This is Sight Unseen. To hear programs you might have missed, please visit Radio Tanya, TANIA.org. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, the UK's first radio art station. And if you're wondering why my voice might sound a little bit strained, it's because I spent a lot of time screaming for Obama yesterday. Stay tuned.